Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily, and sometimes more than daily, politics podcast. I'm John Connolly, and I'm joined today by Fraser Nelson and Katie Balls. Now, if you're just tuning in this morning, or you've just woken up and not seen the results, just to give you a little bit of flavour, the Tories are heading for a majority of around 80, after taking swathes of seats in the North and Midlands. Now, to start us off, Fraser, this might be a bit of an understatement, but this is a pretty good result for the Tories. They're going to be reasonably happy with this, aren't they?
They will be incredibly happy. In the last few days, some Tories were wondering even if they get a majority at all. I know some people who thought it was 50-50, and then when the YouGov poll came out, which suggested that initially it gave them a majority of 67, then they shrank that to the mid-20s, the Tories were then saying, look, we'd be happy if it was a majority of 10, a majority of 15. Anything that's a working majority to get the Brexit deal through would be enough. Now they've ended up with the biggest majority they've had since the 1987 general election, with Labour on its smallest number of MPs since the mid-1930s. So this is, to put it mildly, at the top end of Tory expectations. And the other interesting thing is the share of the vote. Now, all the votes haven't been counted yet, but it looks as if it's going to be 45%. If it is 45%, this will be the highest share of the vote gathered by any political party since 1970. So that means that Boris Johnson will have got a higher vote share than Tony Blair. This is really quite something.
Absolutely. And Katie, you know, we've been talking a lot in the past weeks about the so-called red wall of Northern and Midland seats and how they'll fare up. I think it's fair to say after tonight that it was less a wall, more of a curtain, wasn't it, that the Tories have walked through?
Yeah, I mean, I think you could say they've demolished the red wall. Ultimately, if you look at these swathes of seats the Tories are targeting in their strategy, they've very successfully done that. And there are very early signs. I think earlier in the day, you were getting the impression when you were speaking to both those on the Tory side and the Labour side that the Tories were making big gains in the North East and in the Midlands. They're a bit edgy, I think, about London and the South, but it did seem as though that was the place where it was working out for them. And we had some early signs of that. But I think if you think about some of the seats they have won, I mean, Fraser mentioned some of them there, but you have, you know, Dennis Skinner, the Beast of Bolsover, is no more. You have, you know, seats just like, you know, Gareth Snell, Ruth Smith's sake, Caroline Flint's seat. So ultimately seats where you had Labour leavers in Parliament where they were trying to push, I suppose, for some form of Brexit. They have ultimately been punished by voters for being part of a party that did not seem to be delivering Brexit in terms of Labour. And the Tories have managed to take that opportunity and make huge changes. And if you look also at some of these seats that are now marginal seats, I mean, Yvette Cooper's seat is now a marginal seat. It was once one of the safest Labour seats, but it was 70% leave. And she's now got a majority in the early thousands. I think, you know, it's just under 2,000. I think if you're looking at all also, I mean, you've had a Northwest Durham. Laura Pidcock has lost her seat to the Tories. That is an area of mining towns. And Laura Pidcock has come in and it's been taken by Richard Holden, the former special advisor. And ahead of this, you know, people were saying, oh, it's looking a bit difficult for Laura Pidcock. She's had to do less television and focus on knocking on doors in her seat. But you still got the impression when you spoke to the Conservatives that they thought they could demolish, you know, or take down that majority a fair bit and make it ultra-marginal for the next election. And I think that's how they saw a few seats like that. But actually, the strategy has been more successful than many let on they believed it would be. And seats like that have just gone this time around. So I think you are seeing a different political landscape than one people had before they went to sleep.
I mean, Fraser, this is a complete vindication of the Tory strategy over the past sort of weeks and months, isn't it?
Yes, that's the surprising thing about this election. Quite often, they go right for reasons that they don't quite expect or understand. I mean, David Cameron, at this stage of the 2015 general election, hadn't even written a victory speech because he was so convinced he was going to lose. So quite often, they win for reasons that they don't quite understand. But this time around, the election played out exactly as the Tories thought it would. Their vote has softened in the South. We've seen Dominic Raab's constituency in Surrey. He's now back with a 3,000 majority. It used to be 23,000. We've seen in places like Guildford, we've seen the Tories lose Putney. So the Tories have lost out in these Remain voting places. But as they suspected and as they calculated, they've more than made up for this by gains in the north. I think they now have 2 in 5 seats in Northern England. And this was, they did this by keeping to the very clean Brexit message, get Brexit done. As James Forsyth says in his cover story, which is about to get put on the website, this was at times, they used Brexit, get Brexit done, where they used to say conservative. They would drop the word conservative and just say, we're the get Brexit done party. Mm. Now, this worked. Of course, this is the great caveat now. People are saying, look, these Northerners have just lent you their votes. They're not really Tories. They just wanted Brexit. So this is just a Brexit election. This doesn't show you the success of Toryism. Now, that's as may be, but the Conservatives have got 5 long years to actually get through to these Northern voters and give them more positive reasons to vote Conservative. So the strategy worked. I suppose you could say that Boris Johnson's message discipline worked as well. I thought get Brexit done was a rather boring message, but of course these campaigns are not here for the entertainment of journalists.
Mm. Katie, so my dad woke up this morning, I got a text just simply saying, Lee, ! And that's Lee as in Wigan and Lee, for those who can't quite hear the difference there. Do you think the Tories are waking up this morning and kind of thinking the same thing, as how are we going to keep hold of seats like Lee and Bolsover and Bassetlaw in the North and Midlands that they've never held before?
Yeah, I mean, I think it means that we are seeing a slightly different version of the Conservative Party, but it's one we've already got a flavour of. If you look at the Conservative manifesto, if you look at how Boris Johnson has been pitching himself since he entered 10 Downing Street, and it is a party which is higher spend. I think it's more of a form of blue-collar conservatism. And I think that ultimately, how does this affect what Boris Johnson is going for with his Brexit deal? I mean, I think what's quite interesting is if you look, clearly there's a big Leave vote behind Boris Johnson. He's picked up seats in areas which voted heavily to Leave, but lots of Labour Leave votes. And I think that it is true that if you look at the various reasons people voted for Brexit, often you would find those at Tory think tanks who want Brexit because they see it as Singapore on the Thames. They see it as having this low-tax economy. And you now need to combine that with, I think, Labour Leave voters who actually, I think, tend to be more protectionist. Now, clearly it isn't the same for, you know, all, isn't one size fits all, but I think that when it comes to approaching Brexit now, the party is going to have to probably take in a slightly more protectionist element than perhaps some, such as maybe Jacob Rees-Mogg or Owen Paterson would like. And I think that's going to be one of the interesting currents here. But also, because Boris Johnson is on course for a majority that we believe is going to begin with the number 8 and have another number thereafter, not a majority of 8, he has space to breathe. He ultimately is no longer beholden to one end of the party. The European Research Group of Tory Brexiteers, I mean, Marc Francois can't have a hissy fit and basically force Boris Johnson to try and change tack. And same to be said, even though most of them have been kicked out of the party anyway, but in terms of any MPs who are worried about no deal. And that means, I think, it's really Boris Johnson's to choose what to do with Brexit going forward. And I think because he is someone who is seen as a Brexiteer, he's established that so clearly, he can make decisions that I think others couldn't and still carry it off as an acceptable form of Brexit. So he has all the space to make these decisions now. And I think that if you look at the seats they have picked up tonight, I think that it is not necessarily going to be the Brexit which some in the party have dreamed of. I suppose the most purists.
This is, I think, the extraordinary thing about this result. With the majority of 80, then Boris Johnson can go down his own path, whatever he wants. David Cameron was sort of buffeted by the Lib Dems. Theresa May was buffeted by any old faction in a party who really could deprive it of its majority. But I have got a prediction here. I think that even without the ERG holding any kind of whip hand over the government, he will still play hardball with Brussels. He will say to them that we want a good deal and we're going to do a no-deal Brexit without one. I think that strategy would be far more likely to work because this time he's got the numbers for a no-deal Brexit. He's got the numbers for any kind of Brexit he wants. Theresa May got such a bad deal because looking at her pathetic majority first time around and a non-existent majority second time around, the EU thought, well, why should we really give you any concession because you don't have the authority to come back with any plan of your own. Boris Johnson has got huge amounts of authority now, so I think this will make the Brexit negotiation easier for him. My second prediction is that we're seeing a very different form of Conservative Party, as Katie says, but we're not going to get any significant tax cuts in these 5 years of Conservative government. You might get them at the margins, but this is going to be about high borrowing, about high spending. The sort of policies that people like Sajid Javid would have dismissed as Miliband-esque a few years ago, now he's the one implementing them. When I met him last week in Birmingham, he was telling me about the tens of billions he's going to borrow in order to invest. Now, this is blue-collar conservatism. It's fundamentally different to the Thatcherite free market conservatism. I think a lot of people haven't quite noticed this change, and they're expecting Thatcherism to be unleashed on the country as of whenever Boris gets into work today. I think those people are going to get a pleasant surprise, and those people who do quite like their taxes low and the government small are going to get an unpleasant surprise.
No, just on that, I mean, this is still a broad Conservative Party in many respects. So we just had a result just come in now, which is that the Conservatives have held Cheltenham. Oh, now, that was seen as a goner earlier on in this election campaign. The Liberal Democrats were campaigning really hard there. And it was seen as one of those seats that by pivoting to Leave areas and Labour Leave voters, you would turn off voters in that area. So I think the fact that, you know, they have managed to keep some of these seats, and also in London, if you think about seats like Kensington, which the Tories have held on to, Wimbledon, partly because ultimately you've had that effect where the Remain vote has been split.
Yeah.
But the Tories do want to keep these seats too, so that is going to factor into it.
I mean, where the Lib Dems were strong, that really helped the Tories get in a smaller vote share. That's what we saw with Chuka Emunah. He's the great patron saint of conservatism for that part of London. And I think the funny thing is that the Lib Dems have been pretty much, not quite wiped out, but they've gone nowhere in this election. Their leader has lost her seat. And this time, 2 days ago, the Tories thought, this is terrible. The Lib Dems being weak must mean that Labour is strong. No, that wasn't how it worked out. Labour was weak, the Lib Dems were weak, and the Tories ended up being strong.
Do you think this is the end, then, of tactical voting and the sort of Remain or people's vote surge, then, Katie, now that the Lib Dems have been kind of punished in this way?
Well, I mean, I think you could say of the results, I mean, it just wasn't a very effective tactical voting. I mean, I think one of actually probably the most bad-tempered scenes in terms of the counts that we got through the night was in Kensington, where you ultimately had the Tories very narrowly beat Labour. It was a very small margin and quite hostile noise in the hall. Sam Gyimah, I think, got around 10,000 votes, or close to that anyway, but both Tories and Labour are more like 16,000. And you can see, you know, the blame game starting. And I think there are some in that seat who think the Lib Dems should not have stood there because otherwise Labour would have kept hold of the seat. Now, I still think right now the Liberal Democrats and Labour are too far apart for them to have this pact. But ultimately, and perhaps we're going to move on to this podcast, but if you look at the awful defeat Labour have had tonight, the fact that Jeremy Corbyn has said that he does not plan to lead the party into the next election, I mean, he might have struggled to even if he had wanted to, but you know, we are going to have a fight for the future of the Labour Party. And if you get to a point where the Labour Party and the Liberal Democrats are closer together, yes, they have differences, but it's not to the extent of, you know, a far left party and the Liberal Democrats, I think that's when you might start to see tactical voting working in the future. So I don't think it's over for good, but I think what we saw in this election is if you were just too far apart and you disagree and you were opponents, it's very hard to make it work.
Moving on then to the Labour defeat, I think we've seen since the results were announced sort of two excuses formed from Labour MPs. It's either down to Corbyn or it's down to Brexit or a bit of both. Do you think that assessment is correct, Fraser?
Look, obviously, I think it was down to both of these things. And Corbyn still managed to give the Tories a far greater run for their money than they were expecting, although that might have turned out to be an opinion poll error, because right now it doesn't look as if Labour are a threat to anybody other than themselves right now. But you can see immediately the Labour moderates thinking, OK, surely now we can get rid of this Corbyn nightmare. Surely now they can see that this is not going to win any elections. John McDonnell and Jeremy Corbyn were told going to make a joint statement. Corbyn said he won't fight another election. The problem, though, for Labour isn't so much the leadership, it's the membership. That so many Labour Party members are people who joined the party 3 or 4 years ago in order to support the Corbyn project. Now, if they're going to choose the new party leader, they're going to choose somebody of the same vein. So I'm not quite sure how Labour manages to change that. The bookmakers have Keir Starmer down as the most likely candidate, but Katie has just written a great piece for this in the new issue of the magazine.
Yes, on the various contenders. I mean, Keir Starmer is seen as a favourite, but he does have some things working against him. Number one, he is a man, and there is a big push within the Labour Party to say that they can no longer be the only mainstream party in the UK who has never had a female leader. Some think he might even think twice about running for that reason, but I don't think it will necessarily stop him. I think you're also looking at Emily Thornberry as a strong contender. What's been really interesting tonight is seeing how all the, I suppose, the horses in the race have responded as the result has gone on. So you had Emily Thornberry give a speech at her account where she paid a lot of credit to Jeremy Corbyn but did talk about what the party needed to do, which seemed, I suppose, quite a tactical way of doing it. Jess Phillips was very interesting. She came on ITV and actually was saying how heartbroken she was, but did seem to have a slight smirk on her face at the same time, which didn't go unnoticed with everyone and perhaps wasn't the best look. She was asked if she would run for the leadership, and she didn't deny that she would. She said she didn't want to get into that right now. I mean, I think, as I say in my piece, I think she is seen as a dark horse. I don't think she's actually that popular with the current membership, but obviously you can't completely predict these things. I mean, given that Laura Pidcock has lost her seat, and I think she was seen as the most radical Corbynista, perhaps I think probably the two candidates left who I think are most in line with what John McDonnell and Jeremy Corbyn want, and we could get a statement from them later today, we think, on their plans, Angela Rayner and Rebecca Long-Bailey, who are both, you know, in the shadow cabinet. They're actually housemates, so there is a view that perhaps only one will run because they are good friends.
It's worth mentioning that this is the second time Laura Pidcock's lost her seat to a Tory. She was a councillor before, and she lost that council seat to a Conservative. My point there is that Labour's erosion in its heartlands is not just Brexit. It's been happening for quite some time now. And the Tories have got reasonable grounds for thinking this new Northern Territories of theirs might be here to stay, that is not a Brexit freak. If politics is becoming more aligned now on cultural values, and this is something that is a problem for social democratic parties right across Europe, the left is really struggling. I think the Conservatives have done a slightly better job of responding to these new political concerns than the Labour has. So that is why I think the Tories can be reasonably optimistic that unless they make a mess of the next 5 years, they can probably keep these northern seats. Because Labour, let's face it, looks so out for the count right now that the Conservatives will be thinking that they've just won the 2024 election as well as the 2019 election. Now, you know, nothing stays the same for long in politics, but Labour haven't got that long, really, to reinvent themselves if that's what they intend to do.
And turning last of all to north of the border, I mean, the SNP have had a much better than expected result, haven't they, Fraser? What do you think happened up there?
Well, this was the big surprise, actually. The Tories were quite confident about keeping their 13 seats. It now looks like they're going to get just 6 of those seats. The SNP has been far stronger than people expected. They took Jo Swinson's seat. Really, we've seen almost a return to the SNP surge of the 2015 general election. Now, this will mean perhaps that Nicola Sturgeon is the biggest single force of opposition to Boris Johnson. She performed very well during the television debates, in my view, and she will be wanting a referendum. The Tories say, no, we're not going to give it to you, but I think they'll have to change that. I think that if the Scottish Parliament votes for a referendum, I don't think Westminster's got much moral authority to resist it. So we could be getting Indy Ref 2. A lot will depend on, first of all, the Holyrood elections next year, and also the Alex Salmond trial and how that affects the fortunes of the SNP.
But so not a good night for the union, really, I guess.
No, it's not a good night for the union. And the Conservatives, you know, might be happy that they've kept half a dozen seats where not so long ago they had one, sometimes none. But still, they look far more like an English party than a national party right now. So my takeaway, this is a Scot, is thinking, OK, sure, this is a good day for the Tories, but it is a bad day for the union, and the SNP has got a lot more potency and life left in it than a lot of people thought. The people had been saying a few days ago, well, look at this, Sturgeon's on the run, her domestic record's catching up with her, and the wind is coming out of the SNP sails. But no, there is a massive gust of wind right at the end, and it's taken them through several gains in Scotland right now. And Nicola Sturgeon will be hoping that gust of wind will take her over the next line in the independence referendum.
Brilliant. Thank you, Fraser. Thank you, Katie. And thank you for listening. And if you've had enough excitement this year already, then you might be looking forward to some nice events we've got going on in the new year, particularly our Coffee House Shots live event at the Emmanuel Centre on the 29th of January 2020 at 7 p.m. Katie, James and Fraser will be speaking at the event about what was going to happen in the year ahead. To look at tickets for the event, go to spectator.co.uk/liveshots.